war almost always leads to an increased targeting of women, and Iraq is no exception. Although statistics are hard to come by, reports of violence against women have risen throughout the country since the invasion in 2003. On today's second underreported segment, we look at the network of shelters that's emerged to help these women. And joining me now is Anna Badkhan. Her article, Baghdad Underground, appears in the summer issue of Ms. Magazine. I'm very pleased to welcome her to our show today. Hello.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Why are these women fleeing their homes? Is it always because of violence and sexual abuse?
Most of these women have been targeted by, indeed, militias who either raped them or tried to rape them. But the main reason they're fleeing their homes is because their families no longer want them around. Their families believe that once a woman has been assaulted, she has dishonored her entire clan, her entire tribe. And so very often these women are forced to flee for their lives because otherwise they would be killed in so-called honor killings, which are very, very popular right now in the tribal society in Iraq.
So they're victims twice. The victims
That's
of
right.
the rape,
and
then they're victims of the stigmatization. And as one activist told you, a third of rape victims are murdered by their own families.
Absolutely. It's so common, in fact, and condoned by the government of Iraq that a murder in Iraq, for example, carries a punishment of 15 years in prison, whereas a so-called honor killing usually is punished by 3 to 6 months of prison term, and sometimes people are just let go because everybody sort of understands that they did it for a reason, and the reason was honor.
But what about the Iraqi laws that prohibit violence against women?
Well, evidently, they don't prohibit it enough. They don't protect women from honor killings. They barely protect women from rape. There are, of course, laws that prohibit rape, that punish rape, but very few women actually confront their rapists or file charges because they're afraid of stigma that we've just discussed, or they're afraid of actually being raped again by police officers.
So what happens instead is the rape gets unmentioned. We have no idea how many there are in hopes that we won't see all of this other stuff happening, the honor killings.
What basically happened, Leonard, is that, about 72,000 women have been widowed, and who knows how many young women have been orphaned and don't have, by the war, and don't have the traditional protection of male members of their families. And so these women now become a free-for-all. They don't have protection. They don't have jobs. They, usually have children or are children themselves, and anybody can do with them what they please. And as you've mentioned before in the beginning of your conversation, violence against women is a typical byproduct of war.
Is it mostly by sectarian? Is it most likely Sunni against Shiite and Shiite against Sunni?
Everybody against everybody. I've spoken to Christian women and Sunni women and Shiite women and Sabaean women who have been raped. And, it's because you're of the wrong sect. It's because you're wearing the wrong clothes. It's because you live in the wrong neighborhood. It's because you're walking down the street in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Did the network of shelters that you've written about start up after the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq?
Yes. The organization called the Organization of Women's Freedom in Iraq, which co-runs the shelter with MADRE, which is an international women's rights group based in New York, was founded immediately after the invasion in 2003, and the first passenger of the so-called Underground Railroad was welcomed on board in 2004.
And how does these so-called Underground Railroad work? Is it like the Underground Railroad during the 19th century that helped American slaves escape to freedom?
It's actually quite similar, if not physically, then at least spiritually or metaphysically. Some of the women were literally smuggled out of the country into Turkey, so smuggled north out of Iraq, and from there they were assisted with moving to the States, to Canada. I think somebody moved to Australia. But a lot of women they find safe haven in these shelters for as long as they need to figure out what to do next. You know, a lot of them are uneducated. They don't have a way to support themselves without their husbands or without their families. So sometimes they're trained in certain professions. Sometimes the organization, the shelters, help them go to school and get some sort of a degree. So after they emerge from the shelter, after they're ready to move on, they can live on their own. And a lot of women don't venture very far. A lot of women continue to work at the shelters because that's the only job they know how to do.
Well, it sounds like all of this would require quite a bit of funding. Do they get support from the government?
They do not get support from the Iraqi government. In fact, the Iraqi government, until recently, had prohibited them from running any shelters. And only a couple of months ago, or a month ago, I think, the government of Iraq finally said that they can operate a hospitality apartment. But it doesn't want them to run shelters because it doesn't want to acknowledge that there is a problem.
How did the women even learn about the shelters?
Usually it's word of mouth. One woman I interviewed heard about the shelters in the mosque. A lot of the women who end up in the shelter first end up in Baghdad's red light district because they feel that, you know, that they don't know, they can't do anything else. They become prostitutes now that they have been quote unquote tarnished by having been assaulted. So there are volunteers from the organization that visit the red light district and tell women about these shelters. So it's always word of mouth, and you know, obviously these shelters are very, very low-key, and they actually are not in specific locations. They keep moving around. There would be a shelter here for a few months, and then the shelter would move to a different apartment just to keep, you know, to keep safe.
Because they're under threat of attack?
Because they're under threat of attack from everybody, from the government that doesn't want them to exist, from these women's relatives who still want these women's blood, from sectarian militias that believe that these women are, you know, either promiscuous or, you know, feminists, which is bad, or anti-Muslim. So there, you know, there seems to be no allies to these women in Iraq today.
I'm talking to Anna Butkin, whose article about Baghdad's Underground Railroad appears in the summer issue of Ms. magazine. In the article, you tell the story of Samira. How did she find herself working as an unpaid servant?
Samira's story actually is quite typical, sadly, for women in Iraq today. She was living in Diyala province, which is a province that was part of the so-called Sunni Triangle. It's a province east of Baghdad. And she lived in the outskirts of the provincial capital, Bakoba, which was at one point so dangerous that the locals dubbed it the City of Death. In 2006, the city became a background for the vicious fights between different sectarian militias. And in the span of just 1 month, several various groups of masked gunmen killed all three of Samira's brothers and her husband. Samira was pregnant at the time, and she was in so much pain and so much grief that she miscarried. Her house had been torched after her husband was killed, and so she found herself homeless and without any documents to prove that she was a widow of a police officer, which would entitle her to a meager pension of about $40 a month in Iraqi dinar that the Iraqi government promises, although doesn't always allot war widows. So Samira, you know, this young woman, she was in her mid-20s, late-20s, she found herself out in the street, and she didn't know where to go, and she found this rich, she's Sunni, and she found this rich Shiite family in Baghdad that said that they needed a housekeeper, and she essentially signed up to, you know, clean the house and cook for this family in exchange for room and board, but when she started living there, she realized that the husband of the woman of the house was also going to rape her as part of the deal, and so did the brother of the woman who lived in the house. So she was repeatedly raped by the two men, and then for 3 months, and she tolerated it until these two men and another relative gang raped her kitchen of the house, and then she ran away to a nearby mosque, and that's where she found out about the shelter.
Did this sort of thing happen when Saddam Hussein was in power?
No, it decidedly did not. There was definitely domestic violence, but there was no free-for-all. Saddam kept, you know, his country in terror, and in terror so much that there was very little violence outside the homes, and the only violence that existed was the violence perpetrated by Saddam and his henchmen. So women, you know, to politically probably not, but personally they were much more free under Saddam than they are today. They could wear whatever clothes they wanted, they could go wherever they wanted, they could travel alone in the country abroad, which is very rare for a Gulf state. Most countries in the Gulf don't allow women to travel on their own, or, you know, the Iraqi women could marry or not marry. They could be professors, they could be surgeons. Right now, it's definitely regressed to a very male-dominated society.
Well, we've seen the situation improve there in recent time. You've been reporting from Iraq since 2003. What about the situation for women? Has that improved along with the surge?
It depends on what you compare it to. If you compare it to 2003, no. If you compare it to 2007, yes. In 2006, 2007, women, you know, in 2006, women would be pulled out of their cars and executed for driving. In 2007, women would be executing for not covering an abaya of the right length. The abaya is the long black cloak that sort of covers the woman's body, shape of the woman's body. Or in certain neighborhoods, women would be executed for just walking outside without a male accompanying them. Right now, women can go outside, and they think they can go outside, and they have started driving. I saw my last trip for this reporting trip for this story, which was in the spring. I saw a few women driving, and I saw a lot of women in the street, but they definitely were dressed much more modestly than they used to dress when I first reported from Iraq in 2003, and they're very apprehensive. I think that they're not certain, not clear as to how much freedom they actually have and what they can actually do. What was telling was when I was going to interviews, I would leave my hotel room, I would be dressed in an abaya, and I would cover my hair with a scarf to make sure no hair was showing. And I would arrive at an interview, and it would be usually an office or somebody's house, and the women would see me, and they would be like, "Why are you so covered up? You don't need to cover up. Uncover. Take off your scarf. Iraq is safe now. You can take it off." And so we would sit down. I would take everything off. You know, I'd take off my covering.
Anna, we're going to have to end it soon.
and then I would, when the interview would end, they would say, "Okay, now cover up, because Iraq is not safe."
Anna Batkin's article appears in Ms. Magazine. It's about Baghdad's Underground Railroad. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
On Friday's show, Rolling Stone's Matt Taibbi on why he thinks Goldman Sachs is, in his words, a great vampire squid wrapped around the face of humanity. Then filmmakers Jean-Pierre and Luc Dodin discuss their new movie, Lorna's Silence. Also, the director of New York's Urban Park Rangers talks about our city's unexpected wildlife. Plus, Please Explain is all about obesity. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Blake Neshek, Stephen Valentino, and Julia Corcoran. Melissa Egan is the executive producer. And we had help today from Nicole Silbersack, Sherry Shen, and Adam Delahanty. Debbie Fanta was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. Thanks for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.